Ready to return to the classroom? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
We are in crisis. For me, blaming at this point is counterproductive.
Students in Palm Beach County returned to their classrooms Monday. There are still many questions, including precautions and flexibility for teachers with underlying health conditions. Broward and Miami-Dade are inching closer to bringing students and teachers back. What does the science say about the virus in the community, and how prepared are schools? Also, money. What impact could returning to the classroom have on school funding? Where's the money for COVID-19 measures coming from? If you're a teacher, how will you return to your desk? If you're a parent or a student, are you ready to go back in the classroom? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. We're more than 6 months now into the pandemic, and a lot has started back up again. Restaurants, movie theaters, bars in Monroe County, not quite yet in Miami-Dade, Broward, or Palm Beach counties. Lately, the focus of reopening has really been on public schools. School districts are preparing for students and teachers to return to classrooms. In Palm Beach County, it's as soon as Monday. Broward and Miami-Dade counties are considering October 5th, maybe earlier. Now, the state directed school districts to reopen school buildings for at least 5 days a week. Governor Ron DeSantis has said that parents should have the option between remote and face-to-face learning. The issue over reopening schools has been especially tense this week in Palm Beach County. The teachers' union called for the removal of the superintendent this week. Democratic State Senator Bobby Powell spoke during the school board meeting, saying state education leaders are to blame.
The issue of schools reopening is not necessarily the fault of the school board superintendent. But what I will tell you is that, yes, there probably were missteps, but it starts at the top. The recommendation that schools reopen started with our governor. Our Secretary of Education, Department of Education, Richard Corcoran, push for this.
We're talking about schools reopening this hour here on the South Florida Roundup, taking your phone calls and tweets a little bit later on. We're joined now by Republican State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. He chairs the Florida Senate Education Committee. His district represents parts of Miami-Dade County. Senator Diaz, welcome back to the Roundup. Nice to have you, sir.
Oh, pleasure to be with you on the program again. Thank you for having me.
So let's focus on South Florida, particularly Dade County, Broward County, part of your districts. Do you think public schools should reopen on or before October 5th?
Well, you know, I do think this should reopen. The timing is should be framed with the preparation. So while I do think that we do need to get our kids back in school as soon as possible, I think the districts need to make proper physical preparations, whatever that means in each case. Every school is different. Rebuilding is different. And make sure that we have a safe environment for our kids to learn. But we do need them learning again, and we need them back in contact with their teachers.
What do you think some of those preparations are necessary in school buildings and classrooms?
Well, look, it just depends on the building, right? Because every facility is different. Some may require plexiglass, either in, especially in the office areas where they have to deal with people who may have to come in for certain things. In the classroom, you know, social distance between the desks, plexiglass when it's required, if necessary. I think there's ways to even use plexiglass to allow for some relief from the use of masks from students, depending on how they're sitting. So I think that those kind of preparations, and then just the layout of the space. What square footage do you have? How many students can you bring back? You know, are we bringing back everyone, or are we staggering them? Are you going to have grade levels brought back first? All of those decisions, I think, are best made locally at the actual school site for each building.
And Senator Diaz, from what you can tell, are those decisions in the queue for an October 5th restart in Dade and or Broward County?
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing from both Dade and Broward County, where they are making preparations to get students back. Obviously, Dade has faced some other challenges with the virtual portion, so they're really trying to get students back with their teachers and back to learning. And obviously, you know, there's other services that students are just missing out on, whether it's, you know, speech or it's some of the mental health services that are done at the school site and really don't do as well when they're done virtually. So they are making preparations. The exact preparation, like I said, it's really going to vary from building to building to be able to get these students back in there.
We're speaking with State Senator Manny Diaz Jr., Education Committee Chairman of the Florida State Senate. Senator, is state education funding to school districts at stake if they don't have any in-person classes by October 5th?
No, I mean, I think there's been a lot of confusion with that order. That the order that they're talking about, I think if there's a lot of people that don't understand or misspeaking, is the order provided the opportunity for flexibility. In the state statute, you have to have kids in seats during survey periods in order to get funded. The executive
and that
order
survey period this year begins October 5th, surveying
correct.
Public schools in Florida,
right.
Number of heads in seats, which will determine state funding.
That's
well,
correct.
The amount of funding that comes to the districts.
That's correct. The per student, the student count.
Right.
And what the flexibility allows is it allows for schools to make arrangements that they would normally not be able to make. So you open the schools physically and have the ability to have some of these parents that have chosen, some of this remote live learning. Or if you have to stagger because of the space and the social distancing on the days, then it allows for that flexibility. That wouldn't be allowed under current statute without that order. So when you talk about the state has provided the flexibility for schools to be able to do that. A lot of the critics that are talking against that order, either they don't understand it or they don't want to understand it. But that's really a necessity to have. You know, we really need to have these principals making these decisions on the ground.
Senator Diaz, let's try to clear up some of that confusion, because the state funding is such an important part. It's a majority of money that school districts wind up receiving to spend on education. The Commissioner of Education, Richard Corcoran's order back in July, said that pre-COVID enrollment forecasts could be used, would be used. So when you're talking about flexibility of hybrid learning or some students coming back, clear up that confusion. Can districts essentially ignore enrollment figures on October 5th through the 9th and look at pre-COVID enrollment forecasts to set pre-pupil spending?
Yeah, well, that's become highly technical, so let's clarify one thing.
Okay.
When you say that you're able to use projections, is normally no.
Well, it's not me saying that, Senator. That was in the order from the secretary.
I'm saying as a school system, when you're making these projections for the funding that's going to come in, when you do that, you are going to say, saying, look, we have 300,000 enrollments, right? These are the number of kids that are going to show up at our schools, and that's what we're going to get funded on. That funding starts to be drawn monthly by the school until you get to the survey period. And then at the survey period, whether it's higher and then they have to make the adjustment upward, or it's lower, and then what happens is they start to deduct that from the payments going forward. So it's not like a magic lump sum that's all of a sudden taken
right.
out. And so when the order says that they are allowed to project enrollment based on the numbers from last year, what they're saying is, even though we know you're not going to have kids in the seat, we're going to allow you to start to be funded at that level so that you don't have to worry about making cuts.
So how long does that waiver last, Senator?
So we have to get to the first waiver period, and depending on the plan, remember, each one of these districts had to submit a plan. That's another
correct.
Part of the order that no one talks about. You are allowed to
all the big school districts here in South Florida all had their plans approved by the state. Their reopening plans were stamped as approved.
That's correct. And those plans, they were allowed that flexibility to say, this is our plan to return.
Right.
This is when we're going to bring the students back, and this is how we're going to do it. When students are not physically in the building to be able to provide the education. Once the plan is approved, that flexibility from the statute is given to them, and therefore they don't lose any funding, so they're allowed to continue to operate, even though in a lot of cases it's costing them less money. They're not in their buildings.
Sure.
So
just for
plans, they have to lay out the plan for coming back now.
Right, right. So for clarification's sake, Senator Diaz, if Miami-Dade or Broward, for instance, don't have in-person schooling by October 5th, which is the beginning of the headcount under state statute, do they risk losing state funding?
Well, the way that Miami-Dade's plan was written, and that's what they have to comply with, is that they said that when the county was brought up to phase two, they would bring back the students. And that's what you're seeing. The governor came down and they had a press conference with the superintendent and the mayor of the county that Miami-Dade is going to enter phase two. And at that point, under Miami-Dade's plan, the way I understand it, they start to bring students back.
Well, the way I understand it, there's other gating criteria that the school district put in place, that it wasn't just the phase two declaration, that there were other guidance that had to be hit.
Yeah, and that guidance was taken into consideration, because that's why I believe you saw the superintendent there with the governor announcing that they were going to phase two and that Miami-Dade was going to start the process of bringing students back. I fully expect them to start in some form to bring students back to these classrooms before October 5th. Now, what that looks like is going to, it looks like that's going to be a discussion with the board on Monday, and they're going to.
Right. But my question is, if they don't, if for some reason the board decides not to come back on October 5th, is there, or for that matter, if Broward County doesn't do it, is there a financial penalty? Are they at risk of losing state funding?
Well, they would be at risk if they violate the plan that they have submitted to the state and was approved. They have the ability to request an amendment if necessary, right, if some of those conditions haven't changed. So what I'm saying is, this is not a rigid thing. There's some guidance and there's some check with me put in, check, you know, where they have to request amendments. But this isn't what it's made out to be, which is just a hard and fast rule where you can't change anything. The consideration is being taken as to what the conditions on the ground are.
Yeah. And we'll talk about those next. Senator Diaz, thanks so much for walking us through this. This language here, important stuff, billions of dollars at stake, certainly when it comes to K-12 education. State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. is with us, representing parts of Dade County and Broward County, and also is the chair of the Senate Education Committee. All right, stick with us, teachers, parents, students. If you're on a break from a Zoom class or a Microsoft Teams class, for instance, we'd love to hear from you. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Are you ready to go back into the classroom in South Florida? The South Florida Roundup continues next on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
We recognize that there's a population who wants to come back into our schools, and those families should have that option. So we are working on plans so our students and teachers can return to our schools in as safe a way as possible.
Broward County Public School Superintendent Robert Runcie proposed to have students back in classrooms starting October 5th. He said he plans to make that recommendation to the Broward County School Board on Tuesday in the coming week. The Palm Beach County School Board faces an earlier reopening date. Students and teachers are expected to return to school buildings Monday. School district leaders in Palm Beach County clashed with the county's teachers union this week. The Classroom Teachers Association called for the removal of the superintendent. The school board ultimately ruled that out. Here's board member Barbara Robinson during the meeting on Wednesday.
There's a lot of blame going on, and I think that we each own some of it, some more than others, but we are in crisis. For me, blaming at this point is counterproductive. We can do that later.
So from the Palm Beaches down to the Keys, teachers, students, families, neighbors, what are your thoughts about reopening public schools? Maybe you have a student in a private or parochial school and they have gone back. Let us know what that experience is like. What is going through your mind as the pandemic continues and the debate over school opening, when and how to do it safely, continues? 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number throughout South Florida. 800-743-9576. All right, let's get into this debate around schools opening. Andrew Mara is with us, education reporter for the Palm Beach Post, and WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman is with us as well. To both of you, welcome back to the Roundup. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Hey, Andrew, let's start in Palm Beach County, focus there. What prompted this call by the teachers union to remove Superintendent Donald Fennoy?
Well, it's been something that's been festering for a few weeks now. There's been frustration by the teachers because there was an apparent promise, or at least the possibility, that some teachers with health complications could work home. That wasn't done initially, that a process wasn't put in place for that, which angered teachers a few weeks ago. Now there's an attempt to try and put that in place, but it has not been happening to the satisfaction of the union. And there seemed to be a turnabout in the last couple of days where principals pushed back and didn't want this to happen.
and the superintendent appeared to side more with them and is not approving very many of these remote work policies. And as a result, the teacher union is just became further upset, and tensions have really, you know, reached a new level.
The board ultimately rejected that call. Are there kind of agreed upon rules about this work from home policy for Palm Beach County public school teachers here? I mean, it's Friday and Monday, the school doors are supposed to reopen.
That's right. And that is some of the frustration is that there was an expectation this would all have taken place a couple of months ago, or at least a month ago. Teachers would have an opportunity to apply, get doctor's notes, state their case for why they had complications. Principals could try and make some accommodations. It was always understood that not all teachers would be approved, but at least some of the most serious cases would be. But as you point out, we're days away. And the process that was put in place, what's happened is a lot of teachers have been approved for remote work by the district, but they've left it to the principals to decide. So if I'm a principal of high school, you're my fine arts teacher, do I decide to let you work from home? How do I deal with that? Who picks up that class? It's really complicated in the final days to do that, of course. So principals were upset, teachers were upset, and it all kind of came to a head this week.
Yeah, and Jessica Bakeman, lots of considerations at the principal level. Most noteworthy probably is, do they have a teacher to fill into that space if they need the physical teacher? Because we've heard anecdotally those stories of teachers during this pandemic retiring, calling it quits because of concerns either with the underlying health conditions or just frustration overall.
Anecdotally, I think it might be a little while before we see the numbers as to whether that comes to fruition in the way that, you know, teachers unions, for example, have been warning that it would. But there was a press conference this week with the presidents of the teachers unions in Miami-Dade and Broward counties, both saying we are very concerned that the school buildings are not physically ready for students to come back, you know, just basically saying that they didn't have faith in their school district administrations to follow through on all of the details that they said they would have in place at schools to make sure that students and teachers are safe.
Yeah, Andrew, here we are less than 72 hours before the school doors are supposed to reopen again in Palm Beach County schools. How would you characterize the preparation that's going to happen over this weekend, essentially?
Well, a lot has been put in place, but a lot of things that teachers were like have not been put in place, not just with the COVID contamination issues, but also just with the basic fundamentals of teaching online students and in-person students at the same time. There's teachers in class and students don't have computers yet that they'll need in the classroom. There's a lack of cleaning supplies. Teachers have asked for plastic partitions. Those aren't in place yet. So some things are in place, certainly, but not as much as was initially promised or at least expected. So that has created some frustration.
And is there the sense, the sense or reality of work over the weekend that some of those deficiencies will be addressed?
Some will be addressed, some will not. I think that some plastic partitions are on order and have been promised to at least some teachers in some schools, but they're not here yet. It's just a matter of getting those deliveries. I think the expectation is that won't happen until next month. Other things, of course, are being put in place. Teachers are preparing their rooms, but there's a lot of stuff still happening. They still aren't exactly sure how many students are coming because, of course, some parents haven't responded to surveys. So you're sort of guessing, in some cases, how many students will show up the first day. So there's a lot that's in flux and probably will inevitably be in flux until Monday morning.
Yeah, a lot of uncertainty. And even then, that uncertainty likely to continue as Palm Beach County Public Schools prepare to reopen the classrooms on Monday. Andrew Mara is with us, education reporter with the Palm Beach Post. Jessica Bakeman covers education for us here at WLRN, talking about the march toward reopening. Palm Beach County set for Monday. Broward and Dade counties could happen October 5th, perhaps sooner. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Adolfo in Miami is up first. Adolfo, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Your thoughts.
Oh, thank you. I have two daughters, and they are both teachers. One of them teaches in Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and the other one in Broward County Schools. They are both very worried because they don't feel, number one, that there is not enough protection for children and for teachers and staff to go back to school. And number two, the platforms that they are using is very unreliable. Also, it's very hard for a teacher, they tell me, to be taking care of the students in the classroom, students online, with they both they need to take care of both, and their own children at home. So either they take their own children, they have two kids, each of them.
Yeah.
They take their own children to the school, but then they have to be taking care of the children, their own students, their own kids, and the pupils online. It's a very hard situation. But that's the issue. They feel there is not enough protection from the virus to go back to school physically. But on the other hand, the platform is not reliable. You saw that my Miami-Dade County scratched the platform that they had.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the technology platform and the troubles that Miami-Dade had with K-12 as well as its own internet connectivity. Adolfo, thank you for sharing the stories of your two daughters as teachers in Dade and Broward counties, and thanks to them for the work that they do on the behalf of parents and the whole community here. Adolfo with us in Miami, 800-743-9576. Jessica Bakeman, how about the overall protocols? Miami-Dade is set for a school board meeting next week in which the school board may decide how and when to welcome students and teachers back. What do we know about kind of those preparations?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, you know, there was this press conference with it where the teachers are sort of calling out the school district saying they hadn't done enough. And the response that I got from the Miami-Dade County School District was basically a list of the things that they have put in place and are putting in place now. And, you know, obviously there's a little bit more time in those cases than, you know, with Palm Beach where they're bringing students back on Monday. For example, they have installed 43,000 air conditioning filters throughout the school district, which that's one thing that they were talking about yesterday. There was a meeting of the district's medical advisors, and they were talking about the specific level of sophistication, I guess, that you need for the air filters to make sure that it can filter out coronavirus or that it doesn't, you know, continue to keep it spreading through the air. They've also secured and shut down drinking fountains, instead installing water bottle filling stations. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you don't want kids putting their mouths on the drinking fountains. They have installed 20,000 informational signs throughout the school district, you know, I guess to tell people social distancing and to wear your mask and whatnot. They have unidirectional hallways, so you won't have students going both directions in the hallway where they'll, you know, be bumping into each other. They'll all be walking in the same direction. So those are some examples, but definitely both school districts, Dade and Broward, have a lot of work to do to get ready if they're going to open schools October 5th or possibly sooner.
And Andrew Mara in Palm Beach County, the caller talked about the technology platform that teachers have been using in the virtual environment. As Palm Beach County teachers prepare to go back on Monday, back in the classroom, how are they to deal with the students who will remain online? And will the students in class essentially still be learning in that virtual environment, in other words, on a screen, even though they're in a classroom?
That's been a great debate, and there hasn't been a real great answer to that so far, at least at scale. It's going to depend on the classroom, of course, but it does seem like in a lot of cases, students, even very young students who are sitting in the classroom, will be sitting at their desk on their computer because they'll be doing a lot of work in tandem with students online, where they'll be using, there's a concern about using textbooks and sheets and collecting sheets. So a lot of stuff that would normally be done in a workbook and turned in physically is now being done on the computer. So there will be a lot of that. And so there is a concern that even if you are sending your kid to school every day, they'll still be spending most of their day sort of in a virtual world staring at a screen.
And are the protocols clear for Palm Beach County teachers and parents and students? What will happen if a student or a faculty member or a staff member tests positive when they're back in the classroom?
Yes, they do have protocols in place for that, with the typical, as you'd expect, the 14-day of quarantine or requiring a negative test to return. They're going to be doing contact tracing of some sort in the school. So if it turns out a child, for example, had COVID-19, they would go back and see who the child was in contact with throughout the day. So they do have some plans in place. How it's implemented, of course, once the schools are up and running will be another matter, but they do seem to have a plan for it. They have containment rooms for kids who exhibit symptoms so they can be pulled from the classroom and stay in a separate room until a parent can pick them up. So a lot of stuff is in place, and they are, of course, anticipating having cases throughout the county as time goes on.
Andrew Mara covers education for the Palm Beach Post. He's with us from Palm Beach County. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate you sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jessica Bakeman also with us covering education here at WLRN. Jessica, we got a lot more to talk about here when it comes to the return to school and particularly some of the health metrics that school officials are looking at and what can be anticipated by parents and teachers and students and, of course, the overall community. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number. Maybe you're on a lunch break from a virtual class. 800-743-9576, or you can send us your thoughts on Twitter at WLRN. Talking about the reopening of public schools, the reopening of buildings in South Florida. Are schools ready to reopen safely? The South Florida Roundup continues here on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. I'm Tom Hudson. So South Florida school districts are preparing to reopen and welcome teachers and students back into the classroom pretty soon. Palm Beach County students are expected back in their classrooms Monday. Broward and Miami-Dade school districts are discussing an October 5th start date, perhaps even earlier for reopening the schoolhouse. So we're talking about reopening and bringing students and teachers back to the classroom here amidst the pandemic. Have you chosen face-to-face learning, or will you stay online for an entire school year? Are those your hopes? Are you sticking with online learning, or are you going to go back into the classroom, back on the school bus, for instance? Your thoughts here at 800-743-WLRN. Again, toll-free across South Florida, 800-743-9576. WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman is still with us. Jessica, as Miami-Dade particularly and Broward County both will meet in the coming week to discuss how and when to welcome students and teachers back, the Miami-Dade Public School District announced it will be creating a public COVID dashboard so the community can see the instances of the infection and testing. What's expected to be included in that? What do we know about kind of how that dashboard may be similar or different than other dashboards that we've gotten used to?
So what I know is that it will include new COVID cases among students or employees of schools, and that information will be displayed by school. So as a parent, you'll be able to see if there are COVID cases or how many COVID cases have been discovered at the school where your child attends. A spokesperson for the school district said they expect the dashboard to be live on the first day back, which, as we've been discussing, could be October 5th or sooner. Also, Superintendent Alberto Carvalho, during a meeting of the health advisors yesterday, said and sort of reiterated, because this is something he's mentioned before, that he would like to see a phased reopening where, as he puts it, the most vulnerable students, which would include students with disabilities, as well as the youngest kids, come back first, followed by older kids later. So I'm not certain at this point whether that dashboard would be available like the first day there's one student back in a classroom, or if it's only, you know, for when all students are back. And I'm still waiting on an answer about whether it will be updated daily or weekly. We've seen similar dashboards. There are other school districts that are doing this. Orlando has a dashboard already up and running. The state of New York has a dashboard for all schools in the state. I'm just off the top of my head, those are ones that I know exist, but obviously we've been seeing that here, you know, at the University of Miami as well.
Yeah. You can send us your thoughts about the reopening of public schools on Twitter at WLRN. Robin in West Palm Beach tweeted at us saying, staying online for now, so much uncertainty with what that looks like. Uncertainty on both sides of what the online instructional experience will look like and, of course, what the in-classroom experience is going to look like. Dr. Lisa Gwynn is with us now via Skype. She is a pediatrician serving on Miami-Dade Superintendent's Reopening Committee, director of the University of Miami School Health Program, and recently elected president of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Gwynn, congratulations on that recognition with the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Thank you so much, Tom. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. So lots to talk about, Dr. Gwynn, and we're going to take your phone calls for the doctor as well and for Jessica Bakeman, our education reporter, 800-743-WLRN. October 5th is kind of the earmarked date in Broward and Miami-Dade counties for a return. And as Jessica just mentioned, it may be a phased return. Maybe not all the students that have elected to go back will go back on that day. Is October 5th feasible when you look at the infection rates and the hospitalization utilization?
At this point, our benchmarks that we actually recommended to the superintendent have, we've met most of those benchmarks. We are encouraged by the numbers over the last 14 days. And so we have gating criteria that we created with the district, and pretty much those criteria have, for the most part, been met. There was concerns yesterday on our meeting regarding contact tracing and making sure that we have enough people to be able to do that contact tracing, because it's extremely important, especially when you have an outbreak in a classroom, to be able to mitigate that and to trace the infection back, especially when it comes to children on buses and siblings and other classrooms and so forth.
So what kind of reassurance do you have, or do others in the healthcare and medical community have, that criteria around contact tracing is going to be in place, robust enough and sustainable to welcome students and teachers back?
So unfortunately, we are not privy to all of that information. And so all we can do is provide that guidance and recommendations to the school district and the superintendent. And then it's pretty much left to them on the back end to be able to make sure that planning is complete. So, you know, I can't answer that question completely. I do know that the superintendent has been very, very diligent. Oh, my apologies.
Nope, there's the phone call coming in, Dr. Gwynn. That's right.
Exactly, the school district calling me. Oh, goodness.
Well, maybe we should step aside for you to take that phone call, and maybe they're going to share the contact tracing information with you, Dr. Gwynn.
I will tell you that the superintendent is extremely data-driven. He is very meticulous. He is listening to us. You know, we are public health experts on the front lines. I am a pediatrician as well. We had another pediatrician on the committee, actually two. So it was three of us. So, you know, he's listening very intently, and we all have good intentions. It's just, and we're trying to do the right thing and follow all of the guidelines and recommendations. And so, you know, whether we're ready to go, that's going to have to really be in the hands of the school district. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the best answer that I can give you at this point.
Yeah, Dr. Gwynn, the best advice that you have right now with the data available to you right now, with infection rates well below 10% in Dade County, trending lower, the hospital utilization numbers, in other words, the number of people with COVID in the healthcare system, in ICUs and taking up hospital beds, has been certainly trending lower. Flu-like illness being reported at emergency departments, COVID-like illness symptoms being reported at emergency departments, at least a 48-hour turnaround for COVID testing. That was another metric that the superintendent laid out so many weeks ago. Given the information, the data that you do have, is it your recommendation that the school district ought to move forward with an October 5th return?
So at this point, the data is clear that we can move in that direction. Having said that, however, all of the concerns that have been mentioned thus far in this program are very much concerning to us as well. Making sure that children, the Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that kids get back into school as soon as possible, but it needs to be done safely. And what is that definition of safe? You know, we talk about air quality. We talk about, you know, proper separation. What we're in the weeds on right now is protocols on how to manage children in school, in the classroom, if they do come down with symptoms, how that child is managed. You know, sending them to the isolation room, calling the parents, you know, quarantining classrooms, testing availability, and all of those questions are still being worked out. And so I think that if we feel confident in those protocols, then as far as the community infection rates and so forth that you mentioned, which are the gating criteria, I would say we can proceed.
Dr. Lisa Gwynn is along with us, pediatrician. She is a member of the Miami-Dade County Public School Board Health Advisory Group, discussing the reopening of schools potentially as October 5th, maybe even earlier. Broward County also having the same conversation. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. My colleague, education reporter at WLRN, Jessica Bakeman, also along with us.
Thank you, Tom. I actually have a question for Dr. Gwynn. I was curious, you know, as a pediatrician, what you make of the information that we've seen recently where there's been an increasing number of children testing positive for the virus throughout the country, and also some research that just came out showing that children of color are more likely to die from COVID-19. What is that? I guess, how does that inform the conversation around going back to school?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And actually, one of my team of nurses has been testing children throughout the community since June. We've tested over 7,000 kids. I think one of it may be a little bit misleading, because in the beginning of the pandemic, we really weren't able to test children because of the limited amount of resources. Whether it was PPE and test kits and so forth. So we fought to be able to test children, but in the beginning it was clear that it was because kids weren't really getting sick or having significant complications, that all of the resources were diverted to adults. So not until midsummer were we actually able to start testing kids. Since that time, since everything is kind of built up, there's a lot more testing available right now. So, I think that it's a little, misleading, if you will, that the cases are, we have to wait and see a little longer, whether now that we have more supplies in place and more testing is available for children. Having said that, I will say that once kids go back in person into school, we are gonna see more positive rates. And so that is something that we have to take into consideration. And you mentioned children of color. All of our school clinics that are run by the University of Miami, we are in underserved areas, and we are very concerned for our student populations. And so, you know, what we're really shooting to do is to provide, to be able to have these kids have access to testing. Because that's one of the things that has been really missing is access to testing, especially.
Where best, Dr. Gwynn, where best to intersect with that testing? Is that in the community? Is it at the school? Is it at a clinic? Where is that going to happen?
In a perfect world, if we had the resources, we would be happy to test those kids in the school.
Yeah. What about the world we live in, though?
We're not there yet. And unfortunately, pediatricians, They're having challenges as well, being able to test kids in their offices. Number one, because they can't get a hold of enough tests. And number two, they're in the same situation as the schools are in terms of being able to have a safe, separate area to be able to test, to do the COVID testing. And so that's challenging. So my recommendation is community-based testing, which are run by the Department of Health and other organizations, whether it's the county and so forth. We fought very hard. A lot of these testing sites did not test children.
That's right.
So we fought very hard to make those changes. I worked with the Department of Health and the county so that we can lower the age ranges. My team is testing infants. I'm not sure how many are testing infants, but we're testing infants to age 20 all across the county, but there are other locations as well.
Yeah, and when you talk about the experience at the pediatrician's office, it is an accessibility question for certainly members of vulnerable communities, whether or not they have access to pediatricians. Maybe they, you know, do they have access to insurance in order to have that kind of primary care physician for a child?
Yes, absolutely. So our mobile clinic program, as well as our school health program, all take care of kids that are uninsured. So, you know, we are grant supported and we provide all of this of medical services to these students free of charge. So, yes, access is definitely an issue, not only for to just get medical access, but also testing access.
Right. Dr. Lisa Gwynn is with us, pediatrician, University of Miami, brand new president of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. We're going to take some of your phone calls in just a quick moment. I want to welcome back Jessica Bakeman, who's the WLRN education reporter. Jess?
Thanks, Tom. I had a follow-up question for her. Dr. Gwynn, again, as a pediatrician, I'm sure you've been paying attention to the developments with one of the complications we've seen with children who have been infected with the coronavirus, this inflammatory syndrome. I'm wondering what you'll be watching for as schools open and as there will inevitably be more cases among children, as far as, you know, a potential outbreak of that syndrome, or even, you know, what should parents be looking for if their kids, you know, don't show symptoms that seem to be similar to the coronavirus, but maybe this inflammatory syndrome?
Yes, that's an excellent question. Thankfully, the inflammatory condition is still very rare. However, we have been training our nurses on what to look for. And the other interesting thing about this condition is that it mimics something called Kawasaki's disease, which is also an inflammatory condition, if you will, very dangerous. But in Kawasaki's, it only affects kids up to age 5 or 6, I would say. This condition that's caused from coronavirus actually extends all the way into adulthood. And so all bets are off. And what we see the most commonly is abdominal pain, fever and abdominal pain. So how many kids come through the clinic with a tummy ache? So, you know, it's challenging and it doesn't quite present itself early on in terms of more severe symptoms. And so we've trained our nurses basically to take these tummy aches seriously. And it's actually not on the list, the CDC list of symptoms that we look for, minor or major symptoms for COVID-19. There's nausea and vomiting, but not necessarily abdominal pain. So that's we've tried to counsel our nurses or train our nurses, if you will, on taking it seriously that abdominal pain can be one of those symptoms. And of course, in the office, you know, usually we see kids in the office for that. But I have to tell you, one of the challenges is that most pediatricians' offices right now are not seeing sick visits. They're doing it via telehealth. They're because of the infection, you know, risk. And so that is challenging as well.
Dr. Gwynn, Jessica, we got some phone calls here. Let's run through them, beginning in Miami with Matt on line 4. Matt, go ahead.
Hello. Yes, just... quickly, my wife and I have 4 kids in school right now, and you know, the challenges of technology, we just don't feel like learning is actually occurring. I think as a society, most of us would agree that education is an essential service, and as a society, we've agreed that essential workers, you know, need to return to work. There is few activities in life have zero risk associated with them. You know, my kids jump on the trampoline, they swim in a pool, they ride bikes. You know, we just need to find that place where the cost, you know, of doing the activity, you know, is outright weighed by the gain of that activity. And for education, you know, as a society, the gain is pretty significant to have our kids in school and learning. And for my wife and I right now, we are below that risk threshold where we want to get the kids back in school and get them learning again.
Matt, I appreciate you adding that voice. Jessica Bakeman, what about Matt's point regarding just protection and what we know, kind of what's in the queue for personal protection equipment? We've referred to it a little bit earlier in this conversation, but what's needed, what's necessary, what still needs to be kind of filled in for the districts?
Yeah, you know, what struck me from his comment and also from a comment that we had earlier from the caller who has two daughters who are teachers, mm-hmm. this idea of, you know, teachers being essential workers, and the previous caller mentioned that it was difficult for teachers to take care of their own children while also taking care of, you know, other people's children at school. And, you know, when the pandemic first started and schools closed, child care centers, you know, were equipped to take care of essential workers' children. That was something that the school districts worked out to make sure that healthcare workers had somewhere to send their kids so that they could go to work. And, you know, it's this weird thing where teaching is like being treated as an essential worker on one hand, in that these people are being expected to go to work and put themselves at risk, but I don't think it's really being treated as an essential worker in terms of the supports that need to be in place to make it safe for teachers and to make it feasible for them to, you know, work this into their lives.
Let's squeeze in another call from Miami. Enrique on line two. Enrique, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes, how are you doing? Thank you for taking my call. To Matt's comment, I think I'm entirely against and on the opposite side of that. I don't think if you want to have your kids jumping on a trampoline or putting them in harm's way, that's your choice. But I don't think it's safe for the whole population to have all kids going back to school the way it is right now. As the doctor said, I don't think we're quite there in so many things that I don't feel safe taking my kids back to school. We're not quite there having a vaccine ready. We're not quite there understanding all the problems that and the issues that this virus contains. We're not quite there understanding how quickly and deadly this virus is. I have a very close friend of mine. His dad passed away within 10 days after he was infected.
Sorry to hear that.
I think it's a lot. I appreciate it. I think it's just a lot to put on the table and a lot of risk to have our kids going back to school if we cannot have people, regular adults, behaving properly on a Target and wearing their masks. Imagine kids on a lunch break. I can't even imagine how would that be. In a normal situation, they can behave much less on a pandemic as it is right now. We're not quite there in a lot of things. And like the doctor said, again, we need a little bit more time. So why is the rush? Why do we have to force our kids into harm's way if we need just a little more time?
Enrique, I appreciate you adding your voice to the conversation. Thank you for, and sorry to hear about the loss of your friend's parent there. Enrique in Miami joining us. Dr. Gwen, Enrique did, you know, feel strong. Matt, the previous caller, felt strong about his point of view. As one who's advising school districts, as school boards themselves make these decisions, for parents, for teachers, you know, I've heard, for instance, parents saying, have your younger kids wear masks around the house so that they get used to wearing a mask if they and when they go back to school. What other kinds of things do you think a parent should be thinking about here as we enter into a weekend, maybe the second to last weekend before school gets back in most of South Florida?
Yeah, I think reinforcement starts at home. And, you know, teaching our children that we're living in days that we have to protect not only ourselves, but we have to protect each other. And so starting at home is critical. So in addition to wearing masks, it's also important to follow distancing and that's really difficult for children, even teens. It's almost impossible, but you know, you do your best to just continue to reinforce that at home as well as hand washing. I can't stress that enough.
Dr. Gwen, would you recommend that a student or a teacher get a flu shot before they go back into a classroom?
That's a no-brainer. Absolutely. I mean, if flu vaccines and all immunizations, and that's another part of this that we're seeing since the pandemic started, is that there's been a significant drop in immunization rates because right. their families haven't gotten back into their doctor to have their vaccines, as well as many people have lost their health insurance because they've lost their jobs.
Right.
We actually, you know, that was one of the gating criteria, which we've actually tried to remove that requirement of reaching herd immunity for childhood vaccinations.
Yeah. Dr. Gwen, I'm sorry to interrupt. We've got to leave it there, though. Dr. Lisa Gwen, president of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and medical director of school health at the University of Miami. Jessica Bakeman covers education for us here at WLRN. Thank you to both. Finally, on the roundup this week, tonight, Friday night, is Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the Jewish New Year. It'll be the first time that many people will be observing the high holiday from home.
I've been a rabbi now for 35 years. If you add my student rabbi years to that, this would be my about close to 40 years I've been doing High Holy Days, and I will be at home watching myself on television.
Rabbi Brad Boxman is with Kol Tikva in Parkland. He's already recorded the Friday night service this year. His sermon will be focused on resiliency during the pandemic.
How do we survive spiritually this place that so many people are just in such isolation from each other and depression and anxiety and fear of contagion? And certainly we're a people well acquainted with the night. And so having been through so much persecution and oppression, we are well equipped to find those resources within to persevere and withstand adversity such as this. And I ask our people to look deep within to find those resources that we have that have helped us face the night in many times before.
You can hear more from Rabbi Boxman at WLRN.org. Shana Tova, Happy New Year. That is the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. The WLRN News Director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The Director of Radio Programming is Jason Zabka. And the Director of Radio Operations, plus the show's technical supervisor, is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting Public Radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.